Good morning. It's so good to be together on this Lord's Day morning. And I'll echo everybody else's message to the moms and grandmas here. Happy Mother's Day. And so grateful for all that you do. And I wanted to start with that because this isn't exactly a Mother's Day lesson. I promised a while back that once I finished the James series, those of you who voted on a Bible bracket that I do with in the blog or the podcast that I do, that whoever wins, I was going to preach a sermon on it. And this year's Bible bracket was about favorite Bible women. And there are a lot of amazing moms on this bracket, like Mary and Hannah and Leah and Lois and Eunice. But the winner was Esther. Esther, who my kids love and, you know, I love. The story of Esther is so powerful. But the book's most distinctive trait is actually that God is never mentioned. Well, that's strange. And that has troubled some people. Martin Luther wondered if it should even be in the Bible. The translators from the Hebrew to the Greek, putting together the Septuagint, were so uncomfortable with it, evidently, that they added whole sections to the book to explain how God was working. But the inspired author of the Hebrew text doesn't do that. He challenges us to instead read between the lines or think through the text to consider what is really happening here. Why is there no mention of God in the book of Esther? In fact, why does the book seem to go out of its way not to mention things like prayer in places where clearly prayer was happening? Maybe it's because it was a secularized culture like ours is. Nope. It was a very religious culture, both in the pagan Persia and in the Jews in exile. Maybe because there's no divine message in the book of Esther. But if that's the case, why is it in the Bible? Was the author an unbeliever? Well, I will contend that anything in the Bible is written by a prophet of God. Maybe it's just history without God. It's just telling what we say, oh, it's just secular history. I would contend that there is no such thing. But again, if that is what is happening here, then why do we have this in the Bible? And history without God, that's what the world sees everywhere they look. That's what someone who is an unbeliever will see in the events of Esther. And maybe, I believe, that is the point. See, this is a time when the Jews who are in exile, the first return has happened at this point, about 100 years after the fall of Jerusalem. First return has happened with Zerubbabel, but Ezra and Nehemiah haven't returned. And, you know, there's not a great exodus happening like they might imagine with parting of seas. There's not a prophet like Elijah showing up to do great miracles. And they have rejected God. They had rejected God and were punished for it. And now they're living in the question. What's going on? What is God up to? We have the promises, but we thought we knew how this would play out. History without God. That's what it looks like in our life, isn't it? Sometimes. Sometimes God's actions, his hand is obvious. Sometimes there are plagues and there's a pillar of fire and cloud leading you. But sometimes his hand is unseen. And that's really where I live. most of the time, I have no idea where God's hand is, what his purposes are for my life, other than what I have here. And so we have to ask, is this going to be enough for us? And is this going to allow us to have a lens to see beyond the text, beyond the events, beyond just these things that keep happening where God is nowhere announcing himself? How do you make sense of life when God doesn't show his hand? That is what the book of Esther is really about. It's about God working and yet never saying, here's what I'm going to do next. So the book starts in the days of Ahasuerus. Two things to notice about how this book starts out. First, this is historical. This is King Xerxes I. This is what he's more known by. This is the Hebrew name for him. The Greek name is Xerxes. And he reigned from 486 to 465 BC. So this is set in the real world, in a real time, that everybody could look back on and think through. But also, this is dramatic. This is a master storyteller unfolding events, starting things off, drawing our attention to this glittering luxury in the palace, helping us to see the intrigue in the royal court, and guiding us through this roller coaster of events, twists and turns and ups and downs that keep playing out shockingly until we're left to think, coincidence? I don't think so. Behind the gold and the wine, as these lavish feasts start playing out, the book is really built around feasts. There's these feasts at the beginning and feasts at the end, and they're going to reflect each other. And he starts out with these great feasts, so lavish, it's almost silly. You can't even comprehend it. Just eat as much as you want, drink as much as you want. But behind all of it, there is instability and the beginnings of what I will argue is a divine setup. Though remember, the book never says that. Rather, the book forces us to decide if God is at work at all. So what's the setup? And I brought our Mexican trained dominoes up here to help us think through this. I want you guys to see this. We'll see how this goes, actually. So what's the setup? First, domino number one over here. Queen Vashti is removed after refusing the king's command, and a search begins for a new queen. So far away from Jerusalem, here among the scattered Jewish exiles under Persian rule, a young Jewish woman named Esther is brought into this search. Oh, this ludicrously vast collection that they're doing throughout all the empire, bringing all of the virgins into the king's harem or for examination and being pampered. And so she, Esther, is brought into this palace along with all these many, many others. Domino number two. Domino number three, guided by her older cousin Mordecai, who raised her after her parents died, Esther hides her Jewish identity. And she is brought into the king's palace and she gets the king's favor. This is our word for grace. And it's in the king's eyes, she is shown favor, and she's brought in, and she's seen to be a favorite of his, and ultimately, she becomes the queen of Persia, the greatest empire in the world. God has a way of doing this, doesn't he? Think of Joseph and Daniel and all of these other figures who he brings in to the court where power is to be an influence and to play out in these stories and in these moments of history. Meanwhile, Mordecai, her cousin, he's in the courtyard, just happens to be there whenever a plot is happening between two of the king's eunuchs. And they're going to kill the king. And Mordecai gets word. He probably could have. He's in the courtyard, but he doesn't bring it to the king himself. He brings word to the king through Esther, so she gets some of this favor, and he sends it across, and Mordecai saves the king's life, and yet, you know what? He's never rewarded. In fact, it seems to go just forgotten. The king never does anything with it. And then the deed is recorded in the royal chronicles. Seems to be the end of the story. It's written down in the history books. So there's no miracle. There's no prophet explaining all of this. Just piece by piece, these ordinary events move people into exactly the right place. But we're not seeing yet, and they're not seeing yet why. No one seems to know what's going on. So there's this quote in chapter 4, who knows? And that's our setup for this next section, because what we want to think about is, how do we walk through the fog of not understanding all the details, not controlling the events, and yet having a role to play in the unfolding drama of this world? We have a part, and we won't be able to act out our part without faith. And yet, we don't see anything. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. So what's the problem? Trouble erupts when Haman, this later on in the book, he's called the enemy of the Jews. He's also said to be an Agagite. Little nerdy detail here. Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin, which is where Saul is from, the King Saul, remember? And Haman is evidently a descendant of Agag, who was the enemy, an Amalekite, the enemy of Saul, the enemy of God's people, as king of the Amalekites, who all the way back when they were making their journey to Canaan were opposing and fighting against the Jews. This is one of the oldest enemies of the Jewish people. And Haman shows up, coincidentally, in this place of power, in this spot, and begins to oppose the Jews. Well, it starts out, he just wants people to bow down to him, like everybody does, right? I mean, what a crazy person this guy is. Everybody bow down to me. And when Mordecai refuses to bow down to him, this egomaniac wants to kill him, but not just him. He wants to kill his entire race of people. And so he brings it to the king. And Haman has risen to such high stature with the king that the king is listening to his advice. And Haman says, well, how about if you authorize a decree ordering the destruction of all the Jews throughout the empire, and I'll give all kinds of treasure and put it into the treasury and we'll pay out for this annihilation, this destruction of God's people, of the Israelite people. And he says, here's what I'm going to do. This is an important part of the story. I'm going to roll dice. I'm going to cast lots. And I'm going to find out from that when this destruction is going to happen. The feast that's going to come about, that this is really the origin story of one of the Jewish feasts, it's called Purim. Pur, P-U-R, is the word for lot, word for casting a die. Which maybe is another clue. maybe is another clue that this seems like it's all about chance. Oh, he just threw the dice and, we'll see. It's just luck of the draw. We'll see when this happens and how this all plays out. So read with me chapter 3, verse 8 of Esther first here. It says, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. So what happens at the end of the chapter in verse 15, the king has written that decree, a decree that is so powerful, it's going to bind even the king's hands. And he's used his signet ring and marked it as his and sent it out with authority into the empire. And in verse 15, the couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king. This is like to the known world. And the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. It's like playing your fiddle while Rome burns down. They're taking a drink. Here's to us and our great wisdom as chaos reigns throughout the empire and throughout the capital city. And Mordecai hears of it. So the next verse, chapter 4, verse 1, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. And he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. And Esther hears about her cousin, this father figure of hers, doing this. And she sends fresh clothes to him. And, you know, what's going on? And she hears from him about what is happening. This decree has gone out. And he's going to urge her to go before the king. But the problem is, if anybody comes unannounced, uninvited to the king, they're killed. There's all these twisty problems that happen throughout the book with these rules and these laws that come about. And so will Esther intervene and risk her life? At first she's hesitant, but then Mordecai gives his unforgettable challenge, most famous words in the whole book, and pushes her to be bold. He says, first in verse 13, he says, you know, how do you know that you're going to be okay? Just because you're in the king's court doesn't mean you're safe. Four, if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Well, that last phrase is the most famous phrase in the book, for such a time as this. In other words, there are moments when, hey, maybe this is why you're in that situation, which of course is why she's in that situation. Anybody with eyes to see and ears to hear this story can see God has placed her there. But the book doesn't tell us. Esther doesn't know that. See, as readers, we are in the situation that Esther is in. She knows not what's going on. Mordecai has not received a word of prophecy about this that we read about, a vision, a dream. So he says, who knows? Who knows if this is why, whether you've been put here for that reason? We put it out there on the sign when he came in. Who knows? God knows. Who knows? But we don't always know. Reminds me of Paul's words in Philemon 15 I brought up not long ago in my Providence sermon. Perhaps this is why Onesimus, Paul tells Philemon, was parted from you for a while, that you might have him back forever as a brother. See, Paul, as an apostle, doesn't even know why all the things happen the way they do. God knows. Like us, Mordecai and Paul lived in the perhaps of faith, the mystery of who knows God's precise plan. But notice something else here. He doesn't just say, "Hey, who knows what's going to happen? I don't know. Who can really tell?" He says, declaratively, relief and deliverance will rise. Again, how does he know that? Same way you know it. How could Mordecai know? He knows that the Jewish people have fallen 100 years ago and taken off by the armies of another, serving other gods. People laughing and saying, "Oh, why don't you sing another song?" And by the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept. Yet he believes. He has no fresh word from God about it, but he has the word of God. See, he knows the stories. He knows the promises. He knows the character of his God. And that's all we need. God gives us the wisdom to walk today and the promises to have hope for tomorrow. And he reveals who he is so that we can be in trusting, loving, loyal relationship with him. This is what Mordecai had. Just what we have, even less actually, because he didn't have the whole Bible. This is our tension. This is where we live. Between who knows and deliverance will come. Who knows exactly what God's doing? But I know who God is, and I know what he's promised. So what is that middle empty space called? Faith. Faith is what fills that gap between who knows and deliverance will rise. If we just throw up our hands and hopelessly say, I don't know. Is God really doing anything? Who really knows? That's not where we live. But we also need faith because we don't see everything. Faith is in that silent, empty space. Hebrews 11:1, faith is the substance of things hoped for, gives it solidness, the evidence of things not seen. Mordecai didn't see. He had hope because he had faith. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7, we walk by faith, not by sight. We don't just have faith. We walk by it. We live in it. We act from it. See? That's the challenge that was before Esther. Would she? I believe in the God of Israel. I've been taught. You taught me well. Okay. But will you walk by faith? Are you living by faith? See, as Hebrews 11, that chapter, famous faith chapter, tells us, every person of faith must at some point decide whether they will step out into that territory of risk and sacrifice where you can't see and you're not comfortable anymore and it's not easy and you don't get to live like you could have faith or not have faith and you would walk the same way. You have to decide, will I walk by faith or will I walk by what I see? What she could see was the bad guy had all the power. I mean, Haman is the worst baddie in, at least one of the worst bad guys in all the Bible. He's awful, and yet he's powerful. Is God going to let this happen? Tempted and tried, we're oft made to wonder why it should be thus all the day long. That, you know, we're going through these hardships, and while there are others, you know, never molested though in the wrong, never pulled down and beaten up, at least it looks to us, like they're prospering in their wickedness. So that's what it looked like at this time. Sometimes there's just enough lamplight to take our next step, to know where God wants us to lead. We don't see the whole path, but we know who leads us. Notice, by the way, the text never says Mordecai or Esther had faith. Another word that's never mentioned in this book. But it shows us what they do next. Esther calls for a communal fast. She says, tell all the Jews you know, fast for 3 days and three nights. I'm going to go back with my maidens, and we're going to fast for 3 days and three nights. What does fasting suggest? Just but like a health fast, maybe? You know, like they just wanted to, you know, it's good for it. It reduces inflammation to fast. You've heard that. That is not what's going on here. They are praying for 3 days, but the text never says it. Again, what is going on? It's keeping our perspective down here and forcing us to read into it. You decide. Just like you have to decide about all of life and all of history. Just like you have to decide when you look at a sunset or the ocean or the stars above. Did all that just happen? And then she decides to risk everything. And she says these powerful words. If I perish, I perish. I got to do what I got to do. That's one of my dad's favorite sayings. You got to do what you got to do. What does that mean? Well, that means sometimes your, not just your circumstances, but your character requires you to do certain things. Like Daniel, in Daniel 1:8, who resolved not to do evil, not to defile himself. He purposed in his heart, the New American Standard says. He decided that. And when you decide that, then what happens when the moment comes, the trial, the test, the temptation? You already decided. You can't do anything else. You just got, I'm already, this is who I am. To do something else would be to, going back to James last week, to split ourselves. You know, if you're walking past a burning building and a little girl cries out from the second story and there's nobody around to help, you look around and maybe you feel like, hey, too bad there's nobody else here, and you keep on walking. No, you can't do that. You cannot. And you got to live with yourself the next day. Knowing the sheep, you have to do certain things. And Mordecai put it to Esther in a way that she had to realize, this is a crossroads in your life. What are you going to do? Who are you going to be? What is your story? And this is how we find ourselves in the story of God, is we know his will, we know his promises, we know, Esther knows that God would want to preserve his people. And so she steps into it and she says, well, if I die, I die. Reminiscent of Daniel 3 and the three Hebrews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who said, our God will deliver us. But if not, we still won't serve you. God will do what he'll do. We think he'll deliver us. We know he can. But whatever his will is, we have to do the right thing to follow him. And so she enters the king's presence. She comes in through that curtain. That curtain, to me, felt like a good metaphor for this whole book. Like so much is happening behind the curtain in the true king's courtroom, in the true king's royal court, where he, in heaven, is moving things around. She enters his presence, and he says, what do you want? Up to half my kingdom. And she invites him to a banquet. What do you really want? Nah, just come to the banquet and I'll tell you then. And bring Haman. Bring Haman too. Well, Haman feels pretty good about that. Nobody else but the king and me got invited to the queen's banquet. See how these banquets start playing out. But the last section of the book is captured well in this phrase in chapter 9, verse 1. The reverse occurred. The Bible is full of reversal. It's a book of turning the tables. That's the story of Hannah. In fact, she talks about it in her song, how, you know, the mighty are brought low and the weak are brought high. It's the story of Joseph and Daniel and Moses and David. And ultimately, it's the story of Christ. This idea that the last will be first, the first will be last. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord and he will lift you up. It all turns. One of the great reversals, one of the great turning points in a story in all the Bible, when in chapter 6, verse 1, it says, and the king couldn't sleep. And that, let's see how this works. Hey, they didn't fall. That is the first domino to fall. See, as things start turning, God has set it up, but it starts to play out. On the night that the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds. I love that. I want to have a book of memorable deeds. The Chronicles, and they were read before the king. You know, no ravens feeding a guy, you know, no Red Sea turned to, or Nile turned to blood. Insomnia. You ever have insomnia? Sometimes you can't sleep. Sometimes when I can't sleep, I have an audiobook that I'll turn on and I'll listen to that until I fall asleep. Well, that's what he's doing with like the most boring audiobook ever. He's having his servant read to him the Chronicles of just tell me the stuff that's happened. And he knows he'll probably fall asleep, right? But he hears something that happened. He hears about Mordecai saving his life. And he says, hey, what was the reward that we gave Mordecai? Did he receive some recognition or something for saving my life? No, nothing. Well, this can't stand. Let's honor him. And right about then, you know, Haman comes in and the king asks this question. Hey, what should I do for the man who pleases the king most? Haman, of course, is thinking, that's me. Okay, I've got all kinds of plans, right? You ready for this? So have him marched through the city streets. Everybody's praising him. He's on the king's horse. He's wearing the king's ring, king's robe. And you know, people, the big officials should say good things about him as he goes. The king says, yeah, do that. Do that for Mordecai, your mortal enemy that you hate more than anyone. And Haman ends up walking behind Mordecai saying how great he is. The reversals, the tables turning. And Haman goes home and he talks to his friends and his wife. His wife is like, this is bad. This is really bad. You know, Haman had already received some advice from her before to set up an 8-story high, about 80 feet high, gallows, like a giant pike to put the person that he hates most up on top of. And what's starting to happen, you can see it coming a mile away now, can't you? Is Haman is going to end up on the very gallows he made for his enemy. It becomes the instrument of his doom. And so the queen invites him to this banquet. And on the first banquet, they just celebrate. And on the second banquet, we start to see events play out because the queen reveals that she is a Jewess and she reveals that Haman has tried to kill all of her people. And the king has her seized, or has Mordecai seized and taken away and put on that gallows? Well, it seemed like it was all just chance. It seemed like it was all a roll of the dice. But the reversal that happens shows that maybe it's not all time and chance. You know, there's this passage in Ecclesiastes 9:11 that says, you know, the race doesn't always go to the fastest guy. It's not always the smartest person or the richest person, the wisest person. Time and chance happen to everybody. You know, sometimes Usain Bolt trips, right? I don't know if that actually happened, but he could. He might not win everything. Sometimes something goes wrong. Time and chance happens to everybody. But that's not the whole story. Because Proverbs 16:33 says, the lot is cast, but its every decision is from the Lord. Well, that's interesting. So does that mean that the way I should make my decisions is I should roll dice? Should flip a coin? Should I marry Adrian or not? Flip a coin. That's not the point. The point isn't use this as your way of divining, of looking into the mysterious realm of God's ways. That's not how God speaks to us. He gave us his word. He gives us wisdom. He gives us prayer. He gives us guidance. He gives us help. The point is that even when it looks random, when it looks like chance, God is still in control. God is still reigning above. And he'll bring his promises about. See, Ecclesiastes 9:11, I didn't say part of that verse. It says, for under the sun, time and chance befall us all. This is the key phrase in Ecclesiastes. Might as well be the key phrase in Esther, though Esther doesn't use this phrase. Under the sun, meaning what you can see down here. From the perspective of what you can see down here, certain things look a certain way. Below, it seems like chance and coincidence and chaos, and we want to seek control and get what we can before we die because that's all we can see is what's happening here. Eat, drink, and be merry. There's nothing else. Of course, Proverbs then ends with the preacher's words close up, and the writer who's collected all of the preacher's words says at the end, but fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole of man. There's going to be a judgment. There's more after this life. And so prayer and providence and promises and faith and hope and a kingdom beyond this world, a kingdom that is not of this world, has broken into this world. And it brings wisdom and life and power and a resurrection to come. And that changes everything. And so we set our minds on the things above and we seek the things above, as Colossians 3:1-4 says. There are things we can't see that we know are reality. In fact, are the basis of this reality we can see. And so the tables turn. And Haman falls, but the story is not over because remember, Haman has already set in motion the destruction of the Jews, and the king can't reverse his own decree. He can't eliminate it. So he makes another decree, and he sends them off with this decree that he's going to empower everyone among the Jews to defend themselves. And so throughout the empire, the tide dramatically turns, and the fearful become victorious, and mourning turns to celebration. And from it comes this feast of Purim, as Mordecai and Esther are lifted up, Haman is brought down. We read in Esther 9:1, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the day that Haman had rolled on a die, the reverse occurred. They defeated their enemies. Throughout, it seems very intentional, all of the parallels that have been woven into this book to the story of Joseph. Separated by over a millennium, different lands, and yet The same phrase is used several different times throughout, and we have this Jewish protagonist rising from lowly status in this foreign land and coming to this position where they can save others. And there are these two eunuchs that are playing out in the Joseph story and in this story. And there's the king experiencing troubled nights, and there's banquet scenes and reversals of fortune and hangings. All of these things play out, and this reversal happens. And we might look at this story and say, well, Joseph's story, it said God did it, but this story looks like the Jews saved themselves. It's just a secular history story. But of course, that is not what happened. The Joseph story, the theme of the thing is chapter 50, verse 20. He says to his brothers, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it," or wove it like a tapestry, "for good." No miracles, no mention of God, not even a prayer, and yet God's fingerprints are all over this story and these events. There is, highlighted by the author, but in the events themselves, this rhyme, this, you've heard me talk about chiasms, but it's this reversals reflect each other like a poem playing out. God's making the events rhyme. You know, we write stories about events, but God writes the events themselves, like a poet saying, "Do you see what I made here? Do you see what I wrote? From honored to humiliated, from forgotten to exalted, from death to deliverance." It's like when we look at a strand of DNA and we wonder, Now we understand through the wonders of science and all the work that's been done, that there are these giant strings of data that are writing our design into them that are smaller than we could ever see with our eyes. Do we think that just happened? Do we think all that data design just occurred? You know, if you saw a computer program written that was half as complex as this, would you think that just happened? We say, well, design, that seems to imply there would be a designer. Well, the book of Esther invites us to ask that same question. When you see this design of these events, do you think maybe there might be a designer there? And the point is, we live in Esther, not in Exodus. We live in this place, this time, where we don't have seas parted by somebody raising a staff. But God is just as at work in our lives, just as present. Hidden does not mean absent. His promises are just as solid. Our prayers are heard just as sure as the prayers of Elijah, as we read last week. And we walk by faith and not by sight. And we place our trust in him. And we leave the outcomes to him, but when the moment comes for us to step out and say, "I believe this enough, I trust you enough, I'm loyal enough that I will actually live from this faith," we follow the example of Esther and step out. But Esther isn't the great example of this, is she? Who intercedes for you and me? Remember, Esther put her own life at risk coming before the king to plead for her people. Does anybody do that for you? 1 Timothy 2, there is one mediator between God and man, the man Jesus Christ. He is our great high priest. He has gone through the veil to the right hand of God and pleads for us. He, 1 John 2, 1 and 2 says, is our advocate. He didn't just risk his life to save us. "If I perish, I perish." He drank the cup for us. He died for us. And he lives bringing grace and life, mercy, and the promise of eternal life to any who will come to him. You can place your faith in Jesus and confess him as the true King, the Christ, the Lord, the Son of the living God, and be baptized into him for the forgiveness of your sins. Please come forward while we stand and sing.